recording is brought to you by Whitworth University. To hear additional programs, please visit www.whitworth.edu/podcast.
Good evening. We'll go ahead and get started here in a minute. I'm going to run through my normal reminders real quickly. Reminder to turn off your cell phones or make them so they don't beep. Same thing with computers. We have a number of sign-in sheets available, so Corey will be at the back for Great Decisions, so she'll be back there tonight. So if you're in the Great Decisions class, sign in there. I've got a sign-in sheet also for International Relations and Core 150. I'll put those over here. If you're a visiting high school student who gets some extra credit, come and see me afterwards. I'll sign whatever you need to so that you can get credit for that as well. Just a reminder for the students in Great Decisions that your email is due a week from tonight, and that's about 24 hours away from the end of school, so there can't be any late papers. You need to email those by 7:30. To get credit for the class. So it's due a week from tonight. And just a reminder again of our normal format for lectures. We'll have about an hour of lecture from our guest speaker, and then there'll be 20 to 25 minutes of question and answer where we can follow up and ask questions. Tonight is the last in a series of five lectures that have all sought to inform our community on current political, cultural, and economic subjects that influence global affairs. This is the 54th year that Whitworth's Political Science Department has hosted Great Decisions. And for 31 of those years, Dr. John Yoder has coordinated and/or been actively involved in the program as a tireless champion for global understanding. Next year, Dr. Yoder will be moving into a new phase at Whitworth where he's setting up a semester-long Tanzania program, and heading toward retirement. I draw attention to John because tonight's guest, a former student of Dr. Yoder's, is here as an example of the profound impact he's had on so many lives. I'd like you to join me in thanking John for all that he's done for Great Decisions. He's back up in the corner tonight, so. Again, tonight we welcome back an alum who has a distinguished career since graduating from Whitworth in 1993. After earning her BA in International Studies at Whitworth, Anna Schoengert earned a master's degree in International Affairs from the University of Denver. In 2003, she received the Young Alumni Award from Whitworth, recognizing her work with Catholic Relief Services, where she has been for the past 12 years. During that time, she has managed a food aid program in Liberia, served as senior program manager and acting country representative in Uganda, covering projects in agriculture, microfinance, HIV/AIDS, education, emergency response, and peace-building sectors, and directed humanitarian response in Iraq. She currently guides the agency's acquisition of U.S. government and other public donor funds for relief and development programs around the world. Schoengert also helps with Catholic Relief Services' emergency response efforts. She managed the supply chain for the agency's initial response to the 2010 earthquake in Haiti. And she was part of the startup team that established relief operations in Indonesia following the tsunami there in 2004. Tonight, she will share with us her insights from these years of experience in her talk entitled Humanitarian Aid, A Practitioner's Perspective. Please join me in welcoming Anna Schoengert.
Thank you very much. Good evening. It's amazing to see such a great turnout the last week of school here at Whitworth. I'm pretty impressed. Thank you for coming. Tonight, I am going to take you on a journey, basically on the job with me. I don't really have a message for tonight's talk. I just want to share with you some of the experiences I've had over the last few years in emergency response. We're going to start with the earthquake in Haiti. compare it to a somewhat similar natural disaster that struck the country of Indonesia in 2004, the Indian Ocean tsunami. Talk a little bit about the content, the tasks that are involved in providing emergency response in natural disasters of tremendous magnitude, such as those two. Then we're going to shift gears quite abruptly and talk about another facet of emergency response and post-conflict recovery, and that is restoring community structures, restoring local governance, and helping communities and beneficiaries to engage with their governments and participate in their own recovery from conflict or from natural disasters. And then finally, time permitting, I'm going to share with you one positive example of relief to development transition, moving away from imported food aid and identifying a sustainable solution to post-conflict recovery, talking a bit about my experiences in Uganda and Sudan. Before we get started, though, let me give a couple of disclaimers. First of all, I'm not a photographer, which you'll notice when you take a look at some of these slides. They're not professional. Most of them are mine. There are also going to be some disturbing photos in here. I'll give you a little bit of warning ahead of time, but they're important for you to see. And finally, I'm here speaking on my own behalf. I'm not representing my organization, Catholic Relief Services. I will be referring to CRS a lot in my talk because that's where almost all of my experience is from. But please know that the opinions and the perspectives that I'm going to be presenting are my own and don't necessarily reflect my organization. So let's start with Haiti. January 12th, 2010, 5 o'clock in the evening, a massive earthquake struck right underneath the capital city of Port-au-Prince in Haiti. A couple of factors that distinguished this emergency from others that I've been involved in. First of all, it was pretty much an entirely urban disaster, hit right under Port-au-Prince, and that's something that was new for the international community. We've had emergency responses in cities before. Most of you remember the Bosnian Civil War in the early 1990s. We, the international humanitarian community, had to respond in Sarajevo. But that was a civil, man-made disaster. We could actually prepare for it. We knew it was coming. And the organizations involved were able to prepare and pre-position ahead of time. Of course, we had no warning with this earthquake. It was a very shallow earthquake, shallow depth in the earth. So the impact was very tightly concentrated. And unfortunately, it was right over Port-au-Prince. And also, because it was hit the capital city so hard, it completely destroyed the national government. 30% of all of the government staff in Port-au-Prince were killed, and over half of the government buildings were destroyed. So not only was Port-au-Prince flattened, but the entire country ground to a halt because the national government infrastructure essentially disappeared. Because it hit at 5 o'clock in the evening, the majority of the civil servants of the government were still in their offices, and all of those offices fell down. Port-au-Prince is probably the worst place I could have ever thought of to have an earthquake of this magnitude. Haiti is a very poor country. It ranks second from the last of all countries in the world on the United Nations Human Development Index. And the capital city of Port-au-Prince is densely packed with people. 800 people per square mile was the density of the city before the quake. And because it's in such a poor country, the living conditions were basically pretty much slums. 70% of the population lived in apartments, not houses. And in fact, many people in Haiti are so poor that families shared a room on eight-hour rotations. So maybe three families would share one room for 8 hours at a time and then move out. You know, there's very little land ownership, very few actual houses that are owned and that were owned by the population there. And Port-au-Prince sits on a very rugged, hilly terrain that's entirely deforested. So when the earthquake struck, all of those houses slid down the mountains. A couple of other distinguishing factors about Haiti are that it is on an island. There is not much room to preposition supplies, not much room to move the rubble that was caused by the earthquake. And Haiti shares an island with another country, the Dominican Republic. That proved to be a lifesaver, really, for our relief efforts, because there was a functioning government right next door in the Dominican Republic, and we were able to purchase a lot of supplies from there and move them across the border. Haiti only has one international airport and one seaport that was big enough to handle tankers and barges. Both of those were located in the capital city of Port-au-Prince, and both of them were very badly damaged in the earthquake. So those factors really affected our ability to respond in a timely way. And the final distinguishing factor about Haiti is that it's only 2 hours by air from Miami. So we were able to tap into the United States market for all of the supplies that we had to bring in to respond to the earthquake. But it also meant that all of the supplies that we and other organizations had pre-positioned in Dubai, in Rome, in Malaysia, to respond to the typical disasters we experience in Africa and Asia, were useless. So we had to set up new arrangements in the United States, which was something that was new for a lot of organizations like us. So how did those factors affect our response? 20 million cubic meters of rubble was created just in the capital city as a result of this earthquake. The quality of the construction was very poor. It turns out that the rebar that had been used to construct these concrete buildings was smooth. And anybody who knows construction in this room knows that rebars, that iron rods, are supposed to have ridges to hold the concrete together. They purchased cheap rebar, didn't hold the cement together. Also, they put way too much sand in their concrete to try to stretch it out. So all of the buildings just disintegrated into rubble like this. This is the Catholic Cathedral in Port-au-Prince. This is a school. Fortunately, the quake struck at 5 o'clock, meaning the children weren't in the school, but they were at home. And this was the pediatric ward at one of the hospitals in Port-au-Prince, where, of course, there were plenty of children at the time. So the major challenge that we were confronted with in the immediate days after the earthquake was, where do you put a million Haitians that had lost their homes? 300,000 people were killed in the earthquake, 1.5 million people displaced, almost entirely within the capital city, and over 1,500 camps were created, either spontaneously or set up by relief agencies to house those people. Where do you put them when there's 20 million cubic meters of rubble covering pretty much every surface level in the capital city? If you put all of that rubble into shipping containers, and you stretch, like the kind that are on the back of a semi-truck, and you stretch them end to end, it would stretch 2,200 miles, the entire width of the United States. It's a lot of rubble, nowhere to put it when you're on an island. So the first step is to find the people where they are. In Port-au-Prince, that was quite easy. The survivors all went to areas that were relatively empty of rubble and that were fairly safe. Football fields, golf courses, the airstrips. So the first task of relief workers in those first days are to find the people and to start organizing them, to start creating chutes and registering the people who are in that camp, registering the families, trying to determine how many people are in each family, how many families are there, where they come from, and what their basic immediate needs are. Our usual approach, best practice, is to always register the women of the family, not the men. It's been found after decades of experience doing relief work by all the organizations that if you register women, there's less likely to be violence in the line, and there's a greater likelihood that your supplies will make it back to the family. Food was my first priority as the logistics coordinator for CRS for the Haiti response. And because we were, well, because it was an urban environment, there was not a tradition of cooking over an open fire, which was the only option that there would have been right after the earthquake, and there was no space to have campfires anyway in those crowded conditions. So we weren't able to distribute food for them to cook. Fortunately, because we were so close to the United States, we were able to purchase and fly in ready-to-eat food. And, of course, the United States has plenty of that. My organization ended up managing the camp that was created on the golf course. I think there were a couple hundred thousand people at that camp. And so we developed a food package that met all of the standards in humanitarian response for minimum kilocalories, the number of grams of fat, the number of grams of protein that need to be available to people each day based on a household average household size of 45,000 families. So this is an example. I don't know if you can read it very well, but this is one of the invoices that I placed at Sam's Club a couple weeks after the earthquake. You can see some of the numbers there. I remember one day on the phone, a colleague and I with Sam's Club, I think it was, and we ordered 264,000 cans of tuna fish, 690,000 Nature Valley granola bars, 45,000 jars of peanut butter. Here we've got $2 million worth of saltine crackers. Man, that's a lot of saltines. So we were ordering huge quantities of ready-to-eat food just to carry the people over for the first few weeks until we could establish a more sustainable and less expensive food pipeline. But it was mighty hard getting those supplies into Port-au-Prince. We started up a major airlift that I was responsible for coordinating. American Airlines provided us with free cargo space. We were chartering aircraft wherever we could find them. Fortunately, there are plenty of those in the U.S. as well. But this is a Google map of the Port-au-Prince airport. And you know, the control tower had fallen down in the earthquake, and it was total chaos trying to get these planes in. And once we finally did get all the planes in, we had a heck of a lot of supplies that we had to sort out and inventory and get ready to distribute. We set up temporary warehouses in all of our emergencies, such as this. They're called rub halls. And we hire local staff to help us do the manual labor required for organizing and distributing these supplies. That's me, organizing and distributing supplies. In the back, I'll use this awesome pointer. In the back, you'll see some very colorful bags. We purchased these bags in the Dominican Republic next door to Haiti to create kits, food kits to distribute one bag for each family, hygiene kits where we put soap and toothpaste and toothbrushes and blankets and stuff. And the only sacks available in the Dominican Republic were either Winnie the Pooh sacks or Barbie doll sacks. So we ordered some pretty fantastic looking sacks. I think I've got a better picture of them here. So people were kind of astonished to be receiving those. But one more comment about the Dominican Republic. We were so grateful to have that country right next door, and the people in the Dominican Republic came out of the woodwork to help us. We had an office there anyway. We were purchasing a lot of supplies there. We had volunteers, Dominican volunteers from churches, schools. We had a bunch of Americans who had been staying at an all-inclusive luxury beach resort who came in to help us for a week. It was really fantastic. These ladies are folding up blankets. We provide cash for work for people who were affected by the earthquake. All of these people that you've seen in these slides were displaced. Hiring them as local laborers, of course, provides some cash for them, pumps some money into the local economy, and also gives them something to do. You know, when you're standing around and you've lost your home and you're desperate and you're traumatized after having lost your family members and everything you know, some manual labor can, in fact, be quite therapeutic. So spontaneous settlements began cropping up in every open place. In some cases, it was a safe place for them to be. In others, they were crowding into gullies, which in the lead up to the hurricane season in Haiti was not the place that we wanted them to be. So we had to decongest these camps. We also had to provide tents, every available tent in the United States in January, which is not too many, by the way. There's not much of a tent inventory in this country in the middle of winter, was snapped up within 4 days. The Red Cross bought most of them. We bought about 10,000 of them. There was an immediate movement of tents. And setting up on every available place, trying to adhere to standards about tent spacing. And when we ran out of tents, then we started moving into the distribution of tarps, ropes, nails, for them to create a very temporary shelter using a diagram, a blueprint that we've designed and teach people how to use, and using wood that they salvage from the rubble. And in preparation for the hurricane season, we dug trenches everywhere we possibly could to channel the runoff, recognizing that these tents, these camps, are going to be around for a long time. It's going to take years to rebuild Port-au-Prince, especially since everybody was living in apartments. A lot of politics around it, and it'll take quite a bit of time. So we have to set these camps up to be as permanent as possible. Water, always a critical issue in any emergency. Again, because we were so close to the United States, bottles of water came in on every available airplane. That was okay for the first few days, but it created a mountain of rubble and created a sanitary risk because people were reusing the bottles. So we quickly moved into water bladders. These are equipment that CRS sets up in every camp, in every emergency situation. It holds 30,000 gallons of water. We set up the equipment, and then we partner with organizations like Oxfam and the Red Cross, who specialize in purifying and treating water, and they deliver the water into these bladders. And we set up tap stands for people to get water publicly. I've mentioned a couple of times the standards that we have to follow as relief agencies. They are called the SPHERE standards. We take them to heart. They're kind of like our Bible. For every sector, there are standards that we have to meet in every emergency camp. For the water and sanitation sectors, for example, we have to provide a minimum of 15 liters of drinking water of water per person per day for drinking, cooking, and hygiene. The water source can be no more than 500 meters away from the tents. 20 people maximum per latrine. Minimum of 50 meters from tent to toilet. There are a lot of standards that we have to follow that the entire humanitarian community has agreed to. UNICEF just happened to have several thousand porta-potties handy in the Caribbean, which worked out very well. Usually when in a rural area, we can dig latrines. Couldn't do that in Port-au-Prince where it was so rocky and hilly. CRS did a pretty cool thing that I'm really proud of. We hired a local Haitian graffiti artist to paint some public service announcement kinds of things on the covers of our latrines with spray paint to remind people to wash their hands. And if any of you know French, this is Haitian Creole here, and you'll see that it's pretty closely related to French. But provide some artwork in these camps, something kind of nice for people to look at. The medical response was unprecedented in my experience, and I think in general for the humanitarian community. Again, because we were close enough to the United States, we were able to rotate in medical teams from hospitals in the United States. CRS partnered with the University of Maryland Shock Trauma Center to bring in people on one-week rotations. A lot of injuries resulted from this earthquake. Thousands and thousands of amputations, and trying to do amputations out in the open like that, it was really hard to keep the equipment sterile. The U.S. Navy sent in the medical ship Comfort, which was a great resource. In fact, some of our own staff were treated on the Comfort. And in emergency situations, you set up hospitals with any resource you can. This is a hospital made out of shipping containers. One thing we don't think about often enough is the children and the need to help the children restore a sense of normalcy and a routine to help them recover from a traumatic experience. We set up what we call child-friendly spaces, just a roped-off area where it's kind of like a daycare center, and we hire local women to manage the daycare center. It also serves as a family reunification post. During any emergency, usually the children are separated from the parents, and we work with Save the Children that does family reunification and tracings. In addition to my 264,000 cans of tuna fish, I was ordering like 50,000 blocks from Toys R Us, 10,000 jump ropes, 2,000 googly eyes, like they wanted googly eyes, and I was trying to explain the specs to my purchasing lady for googly eyes. That was a challenge. All right, that was the first couple of months, 4 months in Haiti. That was my experience in Haiti. I'd like to compare it a little bit to another somewhat similar natural disaster that I was also involved in, the Indian Ocean tsunami, which hit December 26, 2004, at about 9 o'clock in the morning, right when the majority of the population were out in the markets buying their food for the day. I'm going to be talking about the island of Sumatra, which was hit really hard by the tsunami. The tsunami hit 6 countries. I ended up working on the Indonesia response, which bore the brunt of the tsunami, and I was focused up here in Aceh province, which is right up there in that little tip. Similar mortality magnitude, 250,000 people in Indonesia, right up in that little corner, were killed by the tsunami, which was generated by an earthquake off the coast of Indonesia. Far fewer displaced people, only about 300,000 total in that area, because it was much less crowded. There weren't major urban centers up there. It was rural and peri-urban populations that we were dealing with there. And another somewhat morbid fact, but I'll share it anyway, is that there were far fewer injuries in Aceh compared to Haiti. The earthquake struck offshore. People were injured by falling debris on land, but if they had been injured, then they weren't able to outrace the waves. So the injured people were killed by the waves as well. This island of Sumatra is a very conservative Muslim population. Women were not taught how to swim. So it was a very disproportionate death rate, majority women, children, and not as many injured as there were in Haiti. These were some of my first impressions. I landed in Aceh 6 days after the tsunami as part of CRS's startup team. It was definitely the worst day of the devastation I had ever seen at the time. Seems like it was worse than Haiti as well, from what I remember. It looked a lot like Japan. The damage was much more spread out, all up and down that coast. Entire communities were completely wiped off the map. However, because The waves reached about 2 to 5 miles inland. So the entire coast was completely gone, full of salt water, in some cases actually gone. But right at the water line, it was perfectly fine and dry and safe. It looks wet down here because it had been raining when I took this picture, but it was fine. So we were able to set up right there, right outside the water line, and people were able to run to that area and to set up camps right there. When I got there, survivors were just starting to come back to assess their homes, to see if any of their family members were left alive, and to see if they could salvage any of their belongings. And these little flags were starting to pop up in certain places. When survivors would find something that had belonged to them, they propped a little flag up there to let other people know that someone from that family was still alive and was out and about, or that this pile indeed belongs to me. You know, don't touch it, don't steal it, don't relocate it. So these flags started to pop up, kind of small signs of life. Body retrieval was underway when I got there. People rescuers and volunteers from the Indonesian Red Cross and other organizations were trying to identify the remains. And in this case, for example, this was an entire family that had been identified, including a baby, as you'll see up there. The bodies were being collected and left on the road for the ambulances to pick up. There were a lot of bodies. I'm going to show you the graphic photo that I mentioned earlier. Here's my little graphic image alert. I'm going to show it. It is disturbing, but one of the things that I remember most from Aceh is the smell. There were bodies everywhere. It was hot. That's not something that we experience watching CNN footage of Japan, but it's a horrible thing, frankly, to see these situations. So it took a long time to retrieve all of these bodies. And one of the other major impressions that the Aceh response left on me was the stunned looks of the survivors that were coming back when I was there, just really, traumatized and had no idea what had happened, had no idea where their family members were. And it was just heartbreaking to watch them and to see their reactions once they finally made it back to where they had come from. This man couldn't find any of his three sons, and he was desperately hoping that we could help him. And this boy couldn't find his parents at all. I'm not sure if he ever did, actually. First step in an emergency response like Aceh, in a geographic area that is very widely spread out, where the population is very dispersed, is to do a rapid assessment. It's very important to find out where everybody is, who is still there, and what their needs are. Also, how many wells are still functioning versus wells that had been saturated with salt water and were no longer potable. How many houses were still standing, how many schools, how many health posts. We collect all of that through assessments with local community members. We usually look for teachers, pastors, religious leaders, mayors, policemen. There are always people in the communities that can tell us the status of their neighbors, at least in places like that. In Haiti, it wasn't so easy. It was easier to find those people because they were all tightly collected. But in urban neighborhoods, they don't have that same community cohesion that they do in more rural areas like this. So we were able to, we had to do a very rapid assessment. And that assessment provides this kind of information. This is a map that compiles the assessment data from many relief organizations, including CRS. And it shows 291,000 internally displaced people that had been counted in this little tip of Sumatra, and every village along the coast, and how many internally displaced people were found in each of those villages. It also assesses, we also assess the condition of the roads and the bridges, which ones are passable and which ones aren't. The tonnage allowance along those roads, can it take a 20-ton truck? Can it take a 5-ton truck? And how much time it takes to get down these roads using a truck, a helicopter, or a fixed-wing aircraft. So this is all really important logistics information that we have to collect through various sources. Usually it's from us just stomping through the mud in order to determine the supplies that we need and how to get them there and where to deliver them. And as with Haiti and every other emergency, there are a whole lot of supplies. We had to use helicopters in Aceh because the roads were all washed out along the coast. CRS is known for our food distributions. We're a well-known food organization, distributing dry rations, but also setting up public kitchens such as this one that in one of those displaced camps along the coast. If you have the ability to cook the food on site and to distribute it and to dish it out to the population, you can control the quality of the food better and minimize, just ensure better hygienic conditions when preparing the food. And There are all sorts of relief actors everywhere, all the time. In Aceh, they came out of the woodwork, official organizations like mine, as well as a lot of individuals who showed up wanting to help, flown in from all over the world. The military played a significant role in Aceh, as they did in Haiti. Maybe during the Q&A, I can talk a little bit about the role of the military in emergencies. I won't do it right now. But tremendous needs for coordinating all of us, making sure that we're not duplicating or overlapping or leaving gaps in service coverage to the populations. It takes a lot of work. The United Nations usually leads the coordination efforts for all of us, and we show up at these meetings all the time. Cleanup started while I was there. Again, Indonesia, Sumatra is an island, just like Haiti. There was a lot of debris to truck away. Because it was a rural area, we were able to dig wells using community labor, as I was explaining earlier. Drop latrines. I know this isn't a very impressive, not a very awesome-looking photo, but sanitation is so important. In Haiti, to go back to Haiti, you know, we staved off cholera for 9 months. There was a cholera outbreak. We knew it was coming. Of course it was coming. It happened in Indonesia as well. You can't stop it when you've got those kind of conditions. But the fact that we were able to stave it off for 9 months in Haiti was really impressive. In Indonesia, we set up these pit latrines, and the reconstruction started while I was there. It was pretty difficult because so many of the people who were displaced, not only had they lost their physical home, but they had lost the land. You know, the farmers couldn't plant on that coast. They're not going to be able to plant along the coast for years because the salt water completely destroyed the fertility of that soil. Also, the earthquake caused some sections of the coast to drop 20 feet into the water. Some of my colleagues floated over the tops of palm trees in boats to reach some of these communities. So what do you do when your land that you have a paper for happens to be 20 feet below the ocean? So land tenure issues are huge in Indonesia. They'll be huge in Haiti as well, and they'll take several years, if not decades, to sort out. And restoring livelihoods. That part of Indonesia relies on a very small fishing industry. We were distributing fishing nets and tools for rebuilding boats, and people were starting to get their boats back in the water and get out there and start making some money. One of the things that I'm most proud of in my time with CRS is something that we did in Aceh. The tsunami struck during the Islamic holy season of Eid, where Muslims go to the mosque and pray and give thanks for their many blessings, which was a terrible irony after what happened to them. Some of you who know Islam much better than I can correct me, but they need to have a prayer shawl and a prayer mat in order to go to the mosque and worship. They didn't have those things. They lost them in the tsunami. So as part of our relief package to the displaced populations, we provided food, soap, blankets, you know, tarps, the usual stuff, and we added a prayer shawl and a prayer mat for each family. And that those two items were more appreciated by so many of the people who received it, even more so than the food. You know, when you lose everything you have, your house, your family, your livelihood, your identity, all you have is your faith. And no matter what faith it is, that's critically important to you. And I just thought, as a Christian organization, showing that ecumenical is a gesture that was just really tremendous. I always take a lot of pictures of kids. It always surprises and cheers me when I see them out playing within days or weeks after a horrible situation. It's restorative. All right. Country number three in our journey tonight. Switching gears away from natural disasters and into what we call a complex emergency. I'm not going to go into the complexities of Iraq. We certainly don't need to rehash that, but it was a country where CRS did not have a presence before the war, before the 2003 airstrikes. We had to go in and start from scratch. But our responsibility was to implement a project that focused on civic engagement and community mobilization, and I'd just like to talk to you a bit about that project. I was based in Basra. I don't have a map, but as you'll recall, the map of Iraq, Basra is right down in the very southern part of the country. It's right where the Tigris and Euphrates rivers come together, and it is supposedly the place where the Garden of Eden was supposed to be based. It was supposed to be right on the Persian Gulf. This is actually a postcard from the 1950s that I found showing what Basra looked like back then. This is what Basra looks like today. Same area. That lower south part of the country is predominantly Shiite Muslim, whereas the upper third, two-thirds of Iraq are Sunni Muslim, Kurdish, and Christian, a few Christians. The lower south is predominantly Shiite, and that entire population had been oppressed by Saddam Hussein's government for 40 years, in part because of the Shiite loyalties to Iran. There was a major war in the 1980s, the Iran-Iraq War, and Saddam Hussein greatly marginalized and persecuted this population in the lower south. Didn't invest in the education system, didn't invest in the health system, and when oil was discovered under those lovely rivers, he drained the marshes. Biggest ecological disaster, I think, ever, and nobody ever seems to really talk about it, and I'm not entirely sure why, but an entire population, the marsh Arabs, their entire livelihood was gone. There used to be fishing, there used to be water buffaloes in this area. So this population, this area had been devastated long before the first Gulf War or the second Gulf War. Our project had two objectives. The first objective was to rebuild community infrastructure, schools, roads, health posts, libraries. But the underlying objective was to reestablish local governance structures in that part of the country. Under the Ba'athist regime, under Saddam Hussein's government, it was illegal to form, to gather as a group in this part of the country. Town councils didn't exist. Those were illegal. They were perceived as a threat to Baghdad. And if anyone had any authority, you know, claimed any authority to represent their neighbors or their ethnic group or their family, they disappeared. So there had been no community mobilization, no community ownership or decision making in that country for 40 years. So our project worked with about 80 communities in and around the southern part of Iraq and in and around Basra to establish what we called community action groups, which were kind of nascent town councils, helping the communities to identify, nominate representative members of their communities to serve on this action group, and helping those community action groups identify the needs of their community, prioritize those needs, and then implement the projects that they decided were the highest priority in their communities. I had thought when I first started this project that the infrastructure work, the construction, would be the hardest part of my job. But by far and away, the community mobilization was much, much harder. This is a population that didn't have this. This is might sound a little bit condescending. I don't mean it to, but, you know, in third grade, we go through student council, right? We all learn kind of how to govern, even in elementary school. And we raise our hands. We were taught from a very early age to raise your hands when you want to speak. That was not the experience of most of the people in the South. If you wanted to speak, if you wanted people to listen to you, you pulled out your gun. It was a very heavily armed population down there, a very violent culture in many ways. So we had to spend a mighty long time just getting these community action groups to debate without resorting to violence, to discuss and prioritize their needs, and to make decisions together, and to not disintegrate into a brawl. So we, you know, spent some time on raising your hand and creating kind of protocols that would define their debate and their identification of the major issues. It took about 5 months, as I recall, for one of our community groups to make their first decision, to decide that their major priority was to clean up the community, a community cleanup campaign. And that was very brave of them to get to that point. Once they had that experience, though, the floodgates absolutely unleashed. It was really incredible. Suddenly, all 80 of these communities... Oh, by the way, this is the best picture I've ever taken. I would just like to share with you. Isn't it beautiful? I just love it. I'm so proud of it. Thank you. Thank you very much. It's so good. I love it. I've got it framed in my house. As soon as the community groups got comfortable making these decisions and feeling like they could speak on behalf of their communities without being penalized and without being thrown in jail or without being disappeared, they immediately started prioritizing everything, you know, and we cleaned up the streets. There hadn't been any trash collection in Basra since the airstrikes of March 2003, and by then this was like August or September of 2003, so there was a lot of trash to clean up. We rebuilt schools, we built libraries, football fields, installed electric lines, pretty much everything that the communities were able to pull together. But one of the most important methodologies that we followed in this project was community contributions. 25% of the cost of each project had to be contributed by the community themselves. Often it was in the form of donated labor, but somebody gave a wheelbarrow, and that counted. Somebody who had some money maybe purchased all of the cement for the school. So the community had to come up with 25% of the value of the project, and sometimes it was hard for them to do, but it was so important because it helped them to feel ownership of the project. It wasn't something that we did for them. It never is. Even in any disaster, even in a life-saving situation like Haiti or Aceh, we cannot make it seem like it's us giving something to them. There are always ways to make the community, to help the community to participate in their own recovery and to feel ownership and direction and control over their own recovery from the disaster. That was certainly the case here. This is a school that we rebuilt. Water purification, reverse osmosis processor that we helped the community install. And this sign is the perfect example of what I was trying to say. It says, if you can't read it, these projects, and it lists all of them, water pipes, paving a road, erection of a bridge, have been completed by the community of Al Jazeera III. Every town in southern Iraq is named Al Jazeera, so some of them are number 14. This one was number 3. In partnership with CRS, our local Caritas partner, and the U.S. government. But what's so cool about this sign is that, you know, we paid for almost all of these projects. You know, we paid 75% of them anyways, and we paid for the engineers, and we paid for the electricians and the oversight and everything. But the community feels like it is theirs, that they did it, simply because they contributed something to it, either blood, sweat, and tears or money. And it's theirs, you know, and it's been our experience in previous emergencies, and I think it holds true for Iraq, that the communities, this is the more sustainable model. If war comes back to this country, I don't know what has gone on in this area for the last few years, but the communities will defend the infrastructure that they feel ownership of. They'll protect it. Whereas if some organization, a company, the military, a contractor comes in and does something for the community, they don't necessarily risk their lives to defend it if they need to. Oh, this is a heavy cup. Thank you for... These kids have just found a soccer ball. They're so excited. All right. Okay, The last topic I'm going to talk about is, I call it beyond imported aid. We've talked a lot over the last 40 minutes about relief supplies, food, other imported commodities that are vital to saving lives and vital to providing some assets back into the community. But CRS is very proud of a new approach that we've pioneered and that other organizations are following our lead on that restores the local economy and local markets even during an emergency situation, even in war situations and in war zones. I'll be talking about the northern Uganda, Sudan, southern Sudan area, this little area right around here. I lived in Uganda for 3 years. As Patrick said, my responsibility was to manage all of our programs in the entire country. We operated up here as well, responding to a low-grade chronic emergency that sometimes wasn't low-grade at all, caused by a rebel group in Sudan called the Lord's Resistance Army. I don't know if you've heard of them. They're still kind of active, but in the early 2000s, they were rampaging up and down southern Sudan, northern Uganda, this section of the Congo, and burning houses, destroying crops, killing people, abducting children to serve as child soldiers, and leading to many hundreds of thousands of people displaced from their homes and crowding into refugee camps in Uganda from Sudan, and sometimes from Uganda into Sudan, depending on where the Lord's Resistance Army happened to be operating. We see a lot of pictures like this when we hear about Africa. When we see an emergency in Africa on the news, we usually see sometimes a desolate place where people are gathering and where food is being distributed or other supplies are being distributed. Or this is actually Congolese refugees coming across the border into Uganda, carrying whatever belongings they were able to salvage on their heads from their villages, running in front of a rebel attack on their village. You know, we see these images all the time. What we don't see so often, and what we haven't really realized or acknowledged in the humanitarian community until the last 10 years, I would say, is that even in the worst disasters, rural populations, farmers like this, they keep some seeds, for example. They don't lose everything. Organizations have been, and the United Nations have been distributing seeds and tools in emergency posts for years, assuming that all of the farmers either lost all of their seeds and aren't able to replant those seeds, even if they were able to go back home, or that they've eaten their seeds in the absence of any food. That's not the case at all. We found that even in the worst emergencies, there are some resources available in the local population. We have established, therefore, a methodology that we call seed fairs. It's pretty great. I'll explain it to you. Acknowledging that there are seeds available for purchase and that there are farmers who do need seeds, who don't have any, we have come up with a pretty simple process, really, of identifying those farmers who need seeds and those farmers who have seeds and bringing them together in a fair type of environment and providing these vouchers as a form of currency for the fair. The people who need seeds or food or non-food items like blankets or soap, it can work anywhere, and we're using it even in urban environments. But for seeds in particular, we print vouchers in different denominations. We distribute them to the beneficiaries. We work with the seed suppliers to catalog the different crops that they have seeds for, the different seed varieties that they have. We work to set some price parameters so that people aren't gouged. And we send out the word of the day of the seed fair, and everybody comes together, and they barter and exchange and transact for the seeds of their choice. This probably doesn't sound very impressive to you, but it's phenomenal because until recently, we have always, like I said, imported seeds to distribute, and those seeds through the United Nations just happen to be whatever seeds were available from American farmers, you know, our kind of corn, which isn't the kind of corn that most people eat in Africa. Crops that are completely unfamiliar to these people and crops that don't grow in African climates. We've never really been able to tap into a local market and reestablish local market structures in the peak of an emergency. So we print vouchers in different denominations. We distribute them on the day of the seed fair. again to the women. And farmers bring what they have, whether it's seeds or food or blankets or, you know, if we were working with vendors, and they use those vouchers as a form of currency. It's safe because the beneficiaries aren't carrying cash in their back pockets. And in war zones, that's certainly the last thing you want to have in your back pockets. It's also safe for the vendors. And it gives farmers a choice. Again, helping them to take a leadership role in restoring their own in their own recovery, in advancing their own recovery. We were able to set up these seed fairs even in pretty insecure environments. Sometimes we do have to partner with the national military to protect the population while they're at the seed fair. It also provides an opportunity for some more for businessmen to introduce new seed varieties and for us to introduce new seed varieties. For example, in Africa, the sweet potatoes are all white. That's just the type of sweet potato that they of yam that they typically grow, in, at least in East Africa, where I'm focusing on here. We have been working with the World Health Organization to introduce orange sweet potatoes, which are the ones that we're most familiar with in the U.S. Orange sweet potatoes have a very high content of vitamin A, and there's a vitamin A deficiency in these populations. So introducing orange-fleshed sweet potatoes through this system works out very well as crops and varieties that are resistant to different diseases. We also have a pretty strict monitoring system during the seed fair day to make sure that everybody is playing by the rules. And the beneficiaries themselves, you know, can weigh and measure and make sure that they're getting exactly what they're paying for. And then the vendors get a hold of the vouchers, and they bring them to us later, and we give them cash. So we don't need to worry about cash in these situations where it's dangerous. And in fact, with cell phone technology that is just everywhere, all over the world these days, even in the most remote corners of Africa, there is a technology now where we can transfer cash into bank accounts of these people through cell phones. It's called M-Pesa. Maybe some of you know of it. So nobody has to touch cash, and it's much safer for everyone. It's amazing. These are actually just agriculture pictures of Africa. I don't really have anything to say about them. I like them. So the seed fair approach is one example of ways that humanitarian organizations like CRS and others are trying to move away from imported aid, which is important at the beginning of an emergency, but is not sustainable, and move more quickly and more efficiently into restoring local markets, restoring local economies, restoring the relationships between groups and between buyers and sellers, and reestablishing responsibility and ownership and participatory approaches in situations such as this. You know, we bring in food, like I did with Sam's Club and like we do with large food aid programs from the United States. It's not efficient at all. It's very expensive to send all of that food on the high seas all the way over to Africa. We are starting to do better about looking for local purchase options. I think CRS and other organizations like us are piloting some initiatives to try to get away from imported food aid. There are a lot of politics associated with food aid. It's a big part of the farm bill in this country. There's a huge agricultural lobby in this country that makes it challenging to get away from U.S. food aid. But it's something that we absolutely have to do. There is food available in so many of these countries. Often, even in the worst situation, like I said, there's food on the market. If there's not food in that locality, at least there's food nearby that we can facilitate bringing in. And often, it's not the availability of food that's the problem. It's the fact that people don't have the money to buy the food. So we need to work out more efficient ways of supporting those economies and those structures in emergencies that doesn't require so much aid coming in from the United States. The end. That's the end of my talk. Look at that. I told Patrick that I was afraid this was going to run over, but that was exactly 62 minutes.
Exactly. So now don't put up your gun. If you want, you can raise your hand. I'll come around, and you can ask questions on any of these experiences. We should have 15, 20 minutes of question and answer.
Hi. I was actually just wondering about your experiences and just, I guess, your resume, like how you were led to becoming a logistics person at CRS.
Sure. I'm happy to. Are you a Whitworth student? Yeah. See, I'm totally happy to answer that because it actually started here. Some of you have probably heard this before. But when I was a junior here at Whitworth in 1992, I did a semester abroad in Kenya. And 1992 was during the height of the Somali Civil War, the Somali refugee influx into Kenya. My semester abroad required me to do an independent study. So I just kind of cooked up this study of the role of different aid agencies in responding to emergencies, just because the Somalia thing was happening. I was hearing about it while I was in Kenya, and I was just curious. So I did a research paper, and I interviewed a lot of people from the United Nations, from different relief agencies like CARE and Save the Children and World Vision. And I was just trying to get a better sense of how they all interact together to respond to a major refugee influx, which was happening in Uganda. And so one night at a bar, I was talking to a person from UNICEF doing an interview, and he said, well, you're actually kind of hypocritical for talking about and writing about refugee camps here in Nairobi. You know, if you want to really say something with any authority at all in your research paper, you should see a refugee camp. And he said, it just so happens that tomorrow morning I'm flying up to a camp on the Somali border with medical supplies to drop off. It's totally illegal, but you can, if you show up at Wilson Airport at 6 o'clock tomorrow morning, you can get on this plane and come with me and see this camp. And, of course, this was in, like, a civil war zone, you know. It was absolutely not safe at all. But, of course, being the 21-year-old that I was like, of course I'll be safe. And I jumped on this airplane thinking that I would come back that night. So I went up there and shadowed him around for the day, and it was amazing. I mean, there were 100,000 Somali refugees coming across the desert right when I was there. They were coming with their camels. They were coming with their donkeys, with their guns. Women were giving birth, you know, right in the sand, and it was awful, just complete chaos. So anyway, I saw that, and I was planning to go back, but that afternoon, a rainstorm washed away the airstrip, and I was stuck there for a week. Totally illegally, by the way. I got in major trouble from the UN people. They had no idea what to do with me. So they put me to work distributing food. Food tokens, actually. It was a little process that they had there. Just to keep me busy and out of trouble. And so I did that for a week. I think it was 5 days. And it was, you know, it was the most amazing experience of my life. I had never felt more useful and never felt as passionate about something, I guess. So when I came back to campus to start my senior year, I went straight to John Yoder and I said, John, I finally get it. I now know what I want to do with my career. And actually, he really helped me to carve out a path. I ended up going to grad school and then getting a job in Washington, D.C. with a think tank where I was able to make some good contacts and do some research that took me to West Africa, and then eventually was able to get a job with CRS and have kind of just been learning as I go. Nowadays, there are some courses, some certificates in humanitarian assistance from quite a few universities in mostly on the East Coast, Massachusetts, a couple of them there. But there's really not much training available to agencies like, to relief workers like me. We have a lot that we're supposed to learn, like these SPHERE standards, but we kind of learn by doing. So, yeah.
What are your experiences? You worked through the women so much, and I was curious how that worked when you were in the strong Shia areas and that. We hear so much about the different religions and stuff. Are the women still people you can rely on and count on, or do the men kind of overshadow their input?
Both, I think. There are some very strong, assertive and aggressive women that I met and had the pleasure of working with in southern Iraq, and there are some very traditional men who didn't like that at all. But there is a role for women in, at least in that part of the world. I'm not an expert. I do not know Islam very well, and certainly not too much about Shia Islam. But there is a role for women there that is respected and acknowledged. It's different than the role that we usually envision, and it's some of us would say it's not an equal role or a respectful role, but it's a different culture there. And the women are really quite strong. And when the community decided to build a school or a health center, it was the women who then took over in the community action group and called the shots, very much so. But being a woman, I've talked to a group, some class students this morning. You guys are going to hear the same thing here, sorry. But being a woman in Iraq, working for an American organization and one that just happened to be Christian, was kind of three strikes. You know, I was pretty worried about all three of those things. I quickly learned that in these community action groups, sometimes depending on the community and how conservative it was, there were certainly variations from one community to the next. But sometimes these community action group meetings were divided along gender lines, and the men would meet in one room and the women would meet in another. And they would discuss and debate things, and then emissaries from each one would go and say, this is what we discussed, what did you discuss? And they would kind of work it out that way, which was interesting. But I quickly learned that I was supposed to go to the women's group for sure and not to the men's group. And my male colleagues would go to the men's group. So I had to adjust how I worked, even though I was the boss. You know, I thought, well, good heavens. But I figured out how to work it. And in fact, you know, being a woman wasn't a problem. Being an American kind of was a problem at that time, but working for a Christian organization was actually a great help. The imams, like those three men in the picture that I showed, they welcomed us. They said, you know, we don't really care what religion you're representing. The fact that you're here because your faith compels you to be here is good enough for us, and we really respect that, much more so than we respect some of these, you know, for-profits who were in there when we were and who didn't have the same, you know, who couldn't identify with at all. And they could identify with us because we were with a faith-based organization. So I was worried that that would be a problem, but it, in fact, really facilitated our work. And those communities protected us. They told us when it was time to leave, and we did leave when they told us to go after a year of being there. But they were our security system. And, you know, they really took care of us, and we were a great team. We were great partners during that year.
Hi. I was just curious, you talked a lot about the main projects and stuff like that, but I was curious what your everyday life was like during these projects. And I mean, that's probably a difficult thing to answer because there's lots of different days, but just your interactions with the people, or if it was mostly mental processing things.
In any particular country?
Yeah, in any of them.
Any of them. Yeah, let's see here. Well, in Iraq, just sticking with that theme for a little while, we lived in a neighborhood of Basra that we were the only foreigners in that neighborhood. We rented a house, and I and my three colleagues, who were also, two of them were Americans, one was Armenian, we shared a guest house, and we worked together, so it was like 24 hours of being together for 12 months and 4 days. That was a lot, but they're great. But I often had to wear a full burqa, in part in deference to the elders that I was meeting with, And then also for my own safety, kind of go undercover. It's amazing what you can carry under these burkas, too. We didn't have any, there were no banks, and we were operating an entirely cash program. It was $10 million of projects that we implemented during that year, and we had to move money. So I would move it because a woman's not going to get touched, you know, in that part of the world. So Mike, I would strap big, thick wads of $100 bills to my belly, and one of my colleagues would wrap saran wrap around my stomach, and then I would throw on a burqa. So I was like staggering down the streets like this, you know. So I spent a lot of time under wraps there in Iraq. But we had 55 local staff. They were fantastic people. We had them over for dinner. They had us over for dinner. They took us out to the area where the Garden of Eden was supposed to have been. They took us to the city of Ur, you know, all these biblically significant places. It was just amazing. It was just a really great year and great living conditions, actually. In Liberia, I lived mostly, sometimes I lived in a tent. Sometimes I lived in a guest house that CRS had rented. It was a house that had been abandoned by their owners who had fled during the war. And, you know, we had just made arrangements with whoever was around at the time to rent it until such time as they came back. CRS is about 95% of our staff are national staff of the countries in which we're working. So always we're with the majority of our national staff, and always we're out in the communities. So I spend a lot of time in the field with the people, which is really great, especially now that I'm based in Baltimore. I love getting overseas and getting out on field trips, and even in emergency situations, even in horrible situations like Haiti and Indonesia, the resilience of people is just always so inspiring, and so I love being out in the population. Does that answer your question? Patrick, there was one back in the back there.
Yeah, the coalition in Britain is balancing the budget, cutting programs and raising taxes, but they said they intend to raise development aid to 0.7% of GDP like the UN asked. So we're getting development aid cut in our government, but they're increasing it even though they're balancing their budget.
That's true. I think if I can restate your comment that the U.S. foreign aid budget for fiscal year 11, the entire U.S. government budget was recently approved, as all of you know, for fiscal year 11, more than halfway through the fiscal year. And the foreign aid budget that targets the very poor, which is where we get our money, we call them the core poverty accounts. There are about 50 accounts in the foreign aid budget. The ones that focus on poverty alleviation, several of them were gutted by our current Congress for fiscal year 11, and it's very likely that they will be for FY12 as well. Our food aid programs, a lot of what I showed you on the screens, were cut. I don't even remember the percentages, but it was steep. So we are going to have to scale back on a lot of our programs that are keeping people alive and keeping children in school and helping farmers recover from catastrophes where their entire harvest was lost. The foreign aid budget of the United States that covers the poverty accounts is less than 1% of the budget, of the federal budget, and it's been the subject of much scrutiny and attack by various members of Congress. And it pales in comparison to the percentages of other countries, although in sheer dollar terms it's pretty big because the U.S. government budget is pretty big. But it's something that is a real problem for us. About 60% of CRS's money, we get about $900 million a year is what we program. About 60% of that is U.S. government funds. A lot of it is food, and the rest is cash, and it's critical for our programs. So we have been advocating on Capitol Hill a lot over the last few months, and I think we managed to save the Child Survival account, and we managed to save the International Disaster Assistance account, but the food aid account and the Global Health Initiative, and a couple of other accounts that we rely on for a lot of the projects you saw here, had some pretty significant hits. So we saved some, we lost some, and we're just going to have to adjust our programs accordingly.
A related question. What would you like to see in terms of either funding from U.S. government or military in terms of providing relief? You talked about some of the private work that's being done as well as nonprofits. How should those fit together, do you think?
Well, I think that the burden is on us in the humanitarian community to be efficient with our resources. And what I tried to communicate here in some of these slides is that I think we're making some strides. You know, we're always looking for ways to be better stewards of the money and better accountable for those resources and to get the results that we need out of the investments that we make in foreign aid. I think it is true that foreign aid targeting the ultra-poor in countries that cannot help their own people is a moral imperative. I mean, I believe that. I think it's something that we are obligated to do. And I also think that there are positive security implications attached to international development. Hillary Clinton's been making those arguments, and I think she's right about that. There are many new actors in the international aid system. It used to just be the U.S. government and private donors, like for CRS, the Catholic community in the United States, where we get 30% of our funding through, well, 20%, I guess, through collection plates and through donations by parishes and dioceses and international Catholic organizations as well. That used to be about it. Over the last 10 years, donors and implementers have come out of the woodwork. The Gates Foundation is huge now. Other corporate philanthropies, Nike, Rockefeller, the Hilton Foundation, the Ford Foundation, lots of new foundations popping up, some of which are family foundations. The son of Warren Buffett, Howard Buffett, he gives us $80 million for water programming in Latin America. So with those new donors, you find a lot of new interests, business interests attached to the corporate foundations. Not necessarily altruistic, not necessarily entirely philanthropic, but attached to business interests or in some cases attached to political interests. And it's hard for us to chart a path through those interests and to make sure that, you know, we have the resources we need to serve the poor. That's our mission. We don't waver from it at all. And there's a debate even within CRS and within a lot of organizations about whose money do we take in order to meet those, to serve the poor. CRS does not take money from oil companies, which means that we can barely operate in Angola because Chevron matches all of the U.S. government funding in Angola. We struggle in Nigeria. You know, there's a lot of places that we don't work because we don't take oil money. There are also other corporations, corporate foundations, that we don't take money from because of their practices around child labor and other issues. So there are a lot of ways of mixing and matching, I guess, the resources that are available and a perpetual challenge to have to get the resources we need and to stay true to our values and our missions. Having U.S. government funding holds us to very high standards of accountability. They have regulations and compliance requirements all over the place. And that's good, you know. It keeps us on our toes, frankly. When I'm saying us, I mean all of the relief agencies. So U.S. government funding and all of the bureaucratic structures that have been created around that foreign aid funding over the last few decades are very important to ensure that we are achieving the results that we need to and that we're adhering to best practice standards, which I believe, you know, CRS does very well and many organizations do very well. So there is a big role. There's a big role for bilateral funding from governments as well as multilateral funding like the World Bank and the Global Fund and the corporate donors who are challenging us to look at aid differently and more from a business perspective, which is valid.
Got one last question down here.
I was just wondering, you mentioned earlier about the role of the military working with the different relief groups, and I was wondering, is that just for the initial initial after the disaster period, and how long are they there, and what role do they play?
Okay. The military has been an increasingly visible actor in international aid. In Haiti and Aceh, they were present, the American military in Haiti, as well as the Australian military in Aceh, and they were critical. I mean, when it comes to providing life-saving services, you can't beat the military. They have the logistics capacity that we'll never have. They can bring in bulldozers to clear the rubble. They can bring in the medical ships that we don't have. And they provide protection and peacekeeping services in countries where it's needed to deliver humanitarian aid. So my personal opinion is that the military is often a tremendously helpful partner in those types of environments. Where I believe the military should not be so involved is in the post-conflict recovery kind of stages, where we are talking about restoring community infrastructure, rebuilding communities, community level, population level development. There is something of a gray line between, the humanitarian space, let's just say, is sometimes under threat by the military, who want to sometimes get involved in recovery and post-conflict development for objectives that aren't necessarily humanitarian in nature. And in situations like Iraq, it ended up being a real problem. One example, just really quickly, I know we're about out of time here, but one example, when I was there, which was May of 2003 to June of 2004, starting 2 months after the airstrikes, one group of the coalition of the international military force that was in Iraq at the time decided to wear the clothing of aid workers, meaning they put their Humvees aside, they changed out of their fatigue uniforms, their military uniforms, and they purchased white Toyota Land Cruisers, which are exactly what the relief agencies always drive around. And they dressed in civilian clothes. Their Land Cruisers were hardened, meaning they had ballistic blankets on the bottom for landmines, they had blast film on the windows, but for all intents and purposes, they looked exactly like the cars that we drive around in emergencies. So once the insurgent population figured that one out, they started hitting any white Land Cruiser that drove by, assuming that there were military in there. And, of course, that put us at great risk. It also made it very difficult for us to convince anybody that we were non-governmental and that we were non-military and we were not part of the coalition. So that's certainly been happening in Afghanistan. I was in Afghanistan for a month a couple of years ago. That was a big problem there as well. And it's something that is a big debate both operationally and academically these days in international aid work is civil-military relations, the appropriate roles for the military, the appropriate roles for relief agencies like us, where we can collaborate effectively and where we should not be collaborating. The War College in Pennsylvania has a pretty fantastic course, actually, on this that we have helped to teach, to present our perspective as non-governmental organizations and the importance of us remaining neutral and impartial and separate from any military action, especially when that military is active in that country and not just being there as a peacekeeper. That's a pretty tricky subject. I hope I answered your question, even though I danced around it a little bit. But it's an interesting dynamic, and those of you who are involved in development, international relations in your studies, I think should follow that pretty closely, because civil-military issues are going to become ever more important over the next few years.
Great. Again, please join me in thanking
you. Thank you.
And she'll be available up front if you'd like to ask any individual questions as well. Thank you again.